Okay, so this is good. Finish off for the day. We'll just do the last questions, and if you have any, I think now we're coming to the end. If you want to ask some more questions, kind of, you know, just orally, please do so. And so you can be a bit more, you know, just open about things if you want to. It's really up to you. See what happens. Okay. Okay, dear respects, Avtan, thank you very much for beautiful teachings. Could you please explain about the 16 vipassana niyamas? Do they come from the Buddha or later tradition? Thank you very much. Avtan, which part of the Pitaka should I read it to know the 16 vipassana niyamas? Okay. Yeah, 16 vipassana niyamas are the things that you find in the many of the so-called vipassana meditation. Yeah, you go to the disciple technique or the Goenka technique, they will use the vipassana niyama. And this all comes from the Visuddhimagga. Visuddhimagga is this big manual of Buddhist practice, which was written by a monk called Venerable Buddha Gosana, who lived in Sri Lanka in about the 5th century AD. And he wrote this book. And you don't find them in the suttas. You find a few things that are a little bit similar in a few places. Mostly you don't find them at all, and you don't find them the way they are, certainly not the way they are explained in the Visuddhimagga. So for that reason, I don't really worry too much about it. What is interesting about Buddhism, it seems like at the earliest time, that's when there were most arahants, the most enlightened people were in the early days, and they had very simple teaching. They're very simple. Just wash the breath and kind of contemplate the permanence, and bang, you're awakened. Arahants. And then they got more and more complicated, less and less arahants. It's simple. It's a simple teaching. You don't have to have all these complex systems. I think the idea, they want to kind of make it very exact, okay, you do exactly this, you follow an exact program. But as you do that, you actually lose a lot in the process. You lose kind of, when you try to specify things too much, in that you see these things in your meditation, whether you have them or not, you still see them because they're kind of, you follow a very rigid program, then you kind of start to see things which aren't necessarily there. And we are all a bit different, so trying to follow a very rigid program, you know, misses the point. So I'm not saying that vipassana is bad, maybe for some people it works, but personally I prefer just to disregard them because to me they're not the word of the Buddha. So keep it simple. Watch the breath. Then, when you come out after the breath meditation, now you look back on the process of the breath meditation, you see the anicca, the impermanence, the viraga, the fading away, you see the nirodha, you see how the hindrance is disappearing, how the breath is disappearing, how everything is changing, and that is how the insight comes about. It's supposed to be simple. It doesn't need this very complicated system. So the Visuddhimagga system is much more complicated. A lot of things in the Visuddhimagga is, you know, just ordinary Buddhism. It's taken from the suttas and quotes from the suttas. There's also quite a bit that is added. And especially the Vipassana Dhamma is one of the bits that is added the most. Whereas the practice for jhana is pretty much what you would expect, except that they use a very strange, they use the earth kasina to reach the jhana experience. And in the suttas, you almost never hear anything about the kasinas. Kasinas are again a much more related development. Kasina means a totality. It's using a certain visual device to, you have a plate or something like that with earth on it, a very kind of simple plate, or you have a color, and you watch that, and you watch it so fully that eventually it takes with the samadhi, these kind of kasina practices. But they're not really explained by the Buddha anywhere. But in the Visuddhimagga, that is the main method, certainly, for meditation. And this is what happens when you move away from Buddhism. You get these very specialized things that are emphasized much more. But if you still want to read it after that kind of demolishment job I just did on that one, you're welcome to read it. You need to go to the Visuddhimagga. Is there anywhere in Hong Kong you get the Visuddhimagga? Yeah, you can? Okay. Where do you have to go now?
Buddhist philosophy bookshop.
Buddhist philosophy bookshop. Okay, that says it all, doesn't it? The Buddhist philosophy, that's
Specialist bookshop.
Yeah, okay. Specialist bookshop. not saying you should read these things. You can sometimes, it's interesting, but usually it's enough to read the sutta. There's already plenty of material there. Respect to you out there. One, when the monks attain enlightenment, why they not say about it? Sometimes they do say, in the suttas, sometimes they say, and they say to each other, and they would say to the Buddha. And it's interesting, when someone becomes fully awakened, the way they say it is quite interesting. They don't say, I am awakened, because that kind of goes against the grain of conceit and self-view and that sort of thing. It's the same or something like, all the defilements are disappeared, when someone, they give an expression of it which is kind of different from saying that I am awakened. I can't remember, there's one very famous story of Sona. Sona goes to the Buddha, it explains his awakening, and he goes through, said a lot, but I can't remember the details now. I have it here on my laptop, but I couldn't be bothered to take it out, so I apologize. But they say it to each other, but they don't say it to the lay community. This is the difference. And I think there are some very good reasons for that. Once you start talking about these things, then it becomes like a competition. It becomes much more difficult to the idea. This is not supposed to be something you brag about or anything like that, but if everybody talks about it, it becomes almost like, a bit of pressure to have this kind of attainment. Have you got it? And maybe it kind of lends itself to all kinds of problems and defilements once you start talking about these things this way. So it is much better in the long run, because you can't trust it anyway. Even if someone says, I'm enlightened, you can't really trust that because people get it wrong all the time. So just watch, observe for yourself. If you see good qualities, then there is grounds for having some confidence. So observe over a long period of time. Observe again and again. And then over time, if you see consistency there, if you see the right attitude, the right things, not too many defilements, ideally no defilements. If you see that in the long run, it's grounds for having confidence. And don't just listen to what other people say, because everyone's teacher is arrogant. You know what I mean? You go to Thailand, and people say, who's your teacher? Oh, my teacher is arrogant so-and-so. They're all arrogants. And the reason, of course, is that we want our teacher to be special. Everybody wants that. So you're going to read arrogance increases. There's inflation of arrogance. Lots of arahants everywhere now. So be careful of the inflationary arahant, because the inflationary arahant is different from the real arahant. So just watch. Trust your own judgment. Don't trust what everybody else says. Most people are pretty clueless. Remember that there is a lot of overestimation and misunderstanding of these things. So just trust your own judgment. At the end of the day, you have to trust your own judgment anyway. As long as you think the Buddha was arrogant, you're okay. Anna, could you explain more details about the Noble Eightfold Path? For example, right view, knowing the Four Noble Truths. Thank you very much for your beautiful explanation. Well, this is kind of what I've been doing all through the last 3 days, talking about the Noble Eightfold Path, or right view. Everything I've been talking about has been about that. Right view, we started with the First Noble Truth. Birth is suffering, old age is suffering, illness is suffering, death is suffering, being separated from what you like is suffering, being united what you don't like is suffering, not getting what you want is suffering. In short, before the five personality factors affected by grasping are suffering. This is what it is. This is what I've been explaining over the last 4 days. This is what it means. This is right view. The more you contemplate that, the more you reflect on that, the more you understand it, the more you take it on board, the more you understand the idea of suffering. But there comes a point when you have the full insight into these things, and the full insight means that you fully understand the idea of suffering. You understand the five aggregates fully as problematic. You understand that craving is the cause for rebirth. All of these things become clear to you. But the most important thing you understand is non-self. You understand that there is no inherent essence in a human being or any other being for that matter. That is kind of the revolution. So when you become a street vendor, it's like having a revolution inside, kind of a turn upside down. Everything kind of changes as a consequence. So just go back and listen to these talks again, and then you will hopefully get more after this. Okay, next question. Is Mara a kind of Asura? As heavenly realm is the highest good realm. Why someone with ill will like Mara can be in a heavenly realm? Okay, is Mara a kind of Asura? Not really. Asuras are kind of lower realm. And the idea of Asuras is interesting because a lot of these ideas that you find in the Buddha Suttas, they actually come from the pre-existing India. India had a very strong religious culture, then going back a long time before Buddhism, the Brahmanical culture, and which is the precursor to Hinduism, that existed in India for maybe 2,000 years before Buddhism. It's a very ancient religious culture. And part of the story, if you read things like the Rig Veda or the Upanishad, these are the ancient Indian Brahmanical scriptures, they also have this kind of stories. So you realize that Buddhism actually has inherited some of these things from ancient Indian culture. So it makes you wonder, you know, how real is it? Yeah, how much has been put in there because they are good stories and they're kind of nice. Anyway, the war between the Devas and the Asuras is not just a Buddhist thing, it goes back to the ancient Indian culture. There's two possibilities. Either Buddhism has just used it because it's close enough to the truth, so just put it in there and it's okay. Yeah. Yeah, or it actually is the truth. It just happens that the ancient Indian culture also had access to those truths, those stories that actually are a good explanation for what the world is like. And you can imagine that, well, human beings, we like to fight. So maybe the devas like to fight a little bit as well then. Maybe the fighting in heaven realm is a little bit less dramatic. And you can't die, perhaps, you know, that's kind of the nice thing about the heavenly realm. You fight and then you capture the other side, and then, you know, after a while you release them and you can carry on fighting. It's not so dramatic. I don't know if you know about the Nordic religions. You know the Nordic religions? They're because I'm Norwegian. You never know much about your own culture. That's what I found out. I never knew enough about Norway. People ask me, I said, I don't know anything about Norway. You always know more about something foreign because it's kind of more interesting. Yeah. So then people ask you if you're embarrassed because you don't know anything about Norway. But I know a tiny little bit. And the Nordic culture, the Nordic religion was about, you know, Odin and Thor. Probably heard about it now because now you have all these movies, the Marvel movies, the Thor, all these kind of things. So everybody gets to know about these things. But their idea of heaven, which was called Valhalla, Valhalla was the Viking idea of heaven. You kind of go to this heavenly realm, and then when you go there, you drink and you fight. Yeah? That's the kind of idea of heaven. But you can't die, so you fight and fight and fight. And you always kind of, in the morning, you wake up and continue more drinking, more fighting. And it goes on like that, I don't know how long, for eternity perhaps or something. That's what their idea of heaven. It's crazy, isn't it? How can you have that kind of heaven? But it's similar to what you find in the suttas here, the gods and the asuras fighting is a little bit the same. Yeah, you can't really die, you just carry on fighting in a sense. It's a similar kind of thing. Yeah. The other thing which is interesting about the Vikings, they also had an idea of hell. But in the Viking idea of hell, it was a cold place. Yeah, if you come from Norway, it's cold. Yeah. In the winter, it's like snow and ice at minus 20 degrees. It's too cold already. So your idea of hell is going to be even more cold. Yeah, that's kind of the idea of hell. It's already too cold. But if you come from a tropical country, or even Hong Kong, where it's hot most of the year, it's too hot usually. Of course, hell is going to be a hot place because it's even more hot. Yeah? So you can see how these things are culturally bound. It's kind of fascinating. Yeah? So is it true? Well, it's still probably true, but truth itself is often relative depending on your background, depending on these things. And very often it shows you that we create the truth ourselves. Some of these realms are mind-made realms. Yeah? So we create them, we make them, and then we go there and we create them. And we think we deserve these things. So is Mara a kind of Asura? According to the Buddhist ideas, no. According to the Buddhist, Mara is much higher up in the very highest kind of heavenly realm, the Parva Nimitta Vasarati realm, it's called just before the Brahma realm. That's where Mara is supposed to be. That's what they say in the commentaries. It doesn't actually say in the suttas, the Buddha didn't say it, it's from the commentaries. is it true? No. I don't know. I have no idea whether it's true or not. But is it possible that someone like Mara can be in the highest realm because Mara has ill will? But I don't think Mara has any ill will. There is all that much evidence that Mara has ill will. Mara is more like a control freak. Mara is someone who wants to bind people to samsara. Mara is like a tempter. Yeah? If you kind of get tempted by some sensual desire or whatever, that's kind of called Mara in the sutras. Mara comes and tempts you. Remember Mara in the story of the Buddha, he had three daughters. They were called craving, desire, or an attachment or something like that, raga or whatever. And these were his daughters. Yeah? So it's a tempting situation. Yes, the monks and the Buddha were tempted by these things. So it's a sensual realm. Well, you have sent for the bhikkhunis. The bhikkhunis, you have Mara comes to the bhikkhunis and says, oh, bhikkhuni, are you practicing like this? Yeah? Forget about this kind of hard practice and instead you know, come back to your day life again. So Mara is the one that tempts you with samsara, with the sensual pleasures. So Mara is more like a power trip than really on ill will. And that might be possible, perhaps, in this higher realm. So. But don't take these things too seriously. Yeah? They are a rough description of reality. Reality is roughly like that. But reality is flexible. Reality is always changing. Yeah? These things aren't set in concrete or in stone. They are pliable things. So. Okay. This brings to you an idea. Some say the last part of the sutra, God realms, hidden the teachings of the Buddha, is not works today. Is it true? You mean the idea that the God realms don't exist, that this is kind of an ancient mythology, it doesn't exist today, and it's not really true? And I would say, I think it is true. Yeah, there are these realms, because this is a very important part of the Buddhist idea of rebirth. Yeah, you can be reborn in different realms. And if it wasn't for the heavenly realms, then rebirth would be a very limited thing if it wasn't for these heavenly realms. But they're not very strange. Remember that the reason they sound so strange is because they are described in the ancient Indian idea of these realms. But because these are largely mind-made, yeah? If you die in the heavenly realm, it won't be like it was in the ancient. It would be a different kind of heavenly realm. It would be made according to your ideas instead. So you're not going to go there and suddenly go back in history 2,500 years. It's not going to be like that. It would be more like made to a modern kind of idea. What is the modern ideal in Hong Kong of a heavenly realm? Is it the kind of, I hear it, Kaduru Sankrena, yeah? Kaduru Sankrena. Yeah, at least that's pretty universal. Probably just means lots of nice pleasures and maybe some of the modern pleasures or whatever, yeah, because the world is pretty small these days. So definitely there are heavenly realms, but not taken too literally. They're not necessarily the way they are described in the sutras. They're going to be pleasurable, they're going to be more happy than the human realm, but more according to modern ideas. Yeah, some places teach only vipassana. Does it work without samadhi? Well, remember that there is no, from the sutra's point of view, there is no such thing as vipassana meditation. Yeah? This is such an important point. Yes, there are teachers today who teach vipassana meditation, but really it's just meditation that they teach. You can't really divide meditation in this way. What you do is you watch the breath, and when you watch the breath, two things happen. You get samatha and you get vipassana. Yeah, you get both. Because vipassana just means clear seeing. You see things clearly. And you want to see things more and more clearly. And the highest kind of clear seeing is wisdom, is eventually enlightenment. That's the highest kind of clear seeing. And as you practice, you build up, both of these build up more and more. You get more samatha, more calm, and more vipassana, more clear seeing. So all you have to do is you have to do bhavana. And when you do bhavana, both of these things can happen at the same time. Yeah? So if you look at what they do at vipassana retreats, they do mindfulness of breathing, they watch the feelings of the body, yeah? Are these things under Vipassana or under Samatha? They are both. If they work, they are both. Because both of these meditation techniques, if they work, they make you calm, they make you see things clearly. It's just a different object, that's all. A different way of focusing it. That's all the difference. So I've had all these things a bit misleading. It's just a label. Yeah, the Vipassana meditation is just a label. It doesn't actually mean that what we do is any different. So sometimes you do different things, and sometimes it's one of the problems with the Vipassana meditation is that they focus much more on the Visuddhimagga, the Vipassanayana, these kind of things. That to me is the main problem, because it is more uncertain. But the idea is just practice meditation. Don't worry about it. Don't worry if it's called Vipassana or Samatha. This is so misleading. Yeah, it doesn't really make any difference whatsoever. Watch the breath. The Buddha says, you watch the breath and you get enlightened. That's all you have to do. Of course, when I say all you have to do, I don't mean it's simple. I just mean if you do it fully, watching the breath takes you all the way to awakening. But you do need Samadhi on the way, otherwise you can't get there. Dear Anna, what does your Dhamma name, Brahmali, mean? Ha, okay. So this is interesting. When I got ordained, I said to Radharam, you know, what? Usually the teacher gives you a name, but not an Amanish. Amanish Radharam says, yeah, find your own name, yeah, I couldn't be bothered. No, he doesn't say it quite like that. He said, yeah, you find your own name, because it's more inspiring when you find your own name, yeah? So then he suggested, well, if you want to find a name, you can go to a place like the Theraganda. Theraganda is a list of all the ancient monks, and there's lots of names in there. Maybe you can find something inspiring. So I did that, and I found Brahmali. Brahmali, okay, I'm a disciple of Ajahn Brahm, so maybe Brahmali is suitable, I thought, yeah, because it sounds like Ajahn Brahm, so I chose Brahmali. And then I found out later on, I didn't know at the time, that Brahmali actually means the lineage of Brahm. Yeah, so it's like a lineage of Brahm, basically, that's what it means. So it means like you are kind of, you know, descendant of Ajahn Brahm, a spiritual descendant or master. But actually, it is exactly the same meaning as the Brahma Vamsa, because Brahma Vamsa also means lineage of Brahma. Yeah. So I found out the name is pretty much means the same as Brahma Vamsa. That was very strange when I found that out. So that's what it means, the lineage of Brahma. So the idea, you know, the idea of being the lineage of Brahma is to have the same qualities as Brahma. That's the idea. So what are the qualities of Brahma? Well, Brahma Viharas. Vihara is to dwell or to meditate. You dwell or meditate like Brahma. The Metta, Karuna, Mudita, Upekka, Purvana Vihara. Okay. Here are that. At which point is thinking useful and at which point is it counterproductive? I often find that when I start meditation, especially if my practice hasn't been consistent, that my mind moves to thinking through some challenge or problem I'm facing. Sometimes the result is that I spend my meditation time lost in the thought. I'm trying to bring my focus to the breath again, but I'm aware that thinking is still happening. And the moment that I allow my mind to watch that, it immediately becomes involved. Thank you. Yes, this is a very common problem, yeah, thinking about the problems of the world in your meditation, and again, the reason why this happens is because of the priorities. Most people prioritize their worldly life. You prioritize your work, your problems, your family life, anything that happens in your life, because that is what is important to us. And this is one of the reasons I talked about giving priority to the spiritual life. Remember what really matters at the end of the day. All of these problems that you're trying to solve, you're going to keep on solving them until the day you die. And there still will be unsolved problems when you die. You never get an end of these things. The only way to deal with these problems is to let them go now and not worry about them. That is the only way. And one of the benefits of meditation anyway is that if you do become a bit peaceful and calm, you have much more power to solve these problems after meditation anyway. Because your mind is clear, your mind is ready, and then you will know how to resolve these things. But the truth is that many of these things are not really resolvable anyway. Now you can't. There isn't any solution to many of these things. And if there is a solution, then you will know at the right time when it's time to look into these things. So change your priorities. Remember what matters in this world. Remember what is ultimately going to make you happy and what ultimately is not going to get you anywhere at all. And if you get your priorities right, then as soon as you start thinking, you remember, wait a minute, what am I thinking about? This is useless stuff. This is not going to get me anywhere. Now, if I could be dead in an hour, what's the point of solving this problem? I could be dead in an hour. No point. Okay, let it go. This is the idea of the death contemplation, to remind you of how ever-present, wherever possible death is, and then you can let things go. So use some of these ideas that I've been talking about during this retreat. They are actually, they may seem simple, but they're quite powerful. Reflect in that way, if you find that the mind doesn't want to be with a meditation object, remember what is really important in this life. When you die, all these problems you have solved, you're not even going to think about them. It's going to be completely irrelevant to you. The only thing that's going to be relevant to you when you eventually die are the qualities in your heart, in your mind, that you take with you into the future. That is what's going to matter to you. And you will feel so grateful to yourself and to everyone else that you have spent your time wisely instead of kind of wasting your time on stuff which didn't have any purpose, didn't have any aim, didn't have any result, didn't have any solution. Most of the problems in the world don't have a solution. Then people say, oh, what shall we do about the, you know, the problems in Hong Kong? Nothing. There's probably no solution. Yeah, forget about it. Just allow things to unfold. That's okay. Things don't have a solution. There's nothing to think about. There's a beauty. I'm sure you heard about that saying. Adam Brown loves this quote. Yeah, there was a famous prime minister in England. Apparently, he was quite a smart prime minister. He was called Harold Macmillan. It was back in the 1960s. And the Middle East, there have been problems in the Middle East for 3,000 years. That's still going on in the Middle East. Nothing has changed for 3,000 years. Maybe it's more than 3,000. I'm not sure now. 3,000 or more. Yes, that's a long time. And almost the same problems. Yeah, the Jews fighting with the kind of the Arabs and this kind of thing. And so Harold Macmillan was asked, well, you know, things are getting pretty bad in the Middle East. Just as they are now, they've always been bad. So what should we do? You know, what do we do about this? Harold Macmillan, you know, what should we do with this problem? And Harold Macmillan said, there is no problem in the Middle East. And I thought, why? What do you mean there's no problem in the Middle East? Yeah, they're shooting each other, they're killing each other. Should we do something to help it out? And Harold Macmillan said, there's no solution in the Middle East. Because there's no solution, there's no problem. Yeah, this is such a beautiful way of thinking. In the world, there is no solution. There may be a temporary solution, maybe things get better for a while, but in the long run, there is no solution. Things will always come back. Things will always get worse, then get better, and then get worse again. What will happen in Hong Kong next? We don't know, but in the long run, there is no solution. By the time you die, there will still be exactly the same problem. Maybe slightly different ones, in a different place or whatever, but the same things. There is no solution in the world, because the world is driven by hatred and greed. As long as there is hatred and greed, then there will always be hatred and greed, because that's why we were born here in the first place. So as long as there is a human realm, there will be hatred and greed. These things are what drive these problems. Because they are driven by that, by definition, is no solution. So stop trying to find solutions when there is no solution. Just allow it to be. Just drop it. Help out out of the goodness of your heart. Do what is good for the people around you. Be kind. And then do the best you can. But don't be surprised if there is no solution. Because that is the long-term reality of the human realm. So try some thoughts like that and see what happens. See if it works out. Okay, here has that. In our daily life, we commit wrongdoings, knowingly or unknowingly. Is there a way to seek the Lord Buddha's forgiveness for the wrongdoings? Don't get on our book of bad karma. Or can we simply pardon ourselves? Thank you. Forget about the Buddha is dead. Yeah? He cannot give you forgiveness anymore. He died 2,500 years ago, so forget about the Buddha. Instead, the person you need to forgive is yourself. Yeah? If you do something bad, forgive yourself just as you forgive the people around you. And this is one of the great benefits of forgiving other people. If you're able to forgive others, you're also much better at forgiving yourself. If you are hard against other people, if you're hard-hearted towards them, you're going to be hard towards yourself and not be able to forgive yourself. Because we can't really distinguish between others and ourselves. Yeah? The way we treat ourselves is the way we treat others. The way we treat others, the way we treat ourselves. It's just an attitude that we have. We can't really change that. So for that reason, the best thing you can do is make a mistake. First of all, don't get upset with yourself. Yeah? Everyone is going to make mistakes. This is the nature of things. So it's okay to make mistakes. And when you make a mistake, instead of getting upset with yourself, instead of getting guilty or shameful or whatever, ask yourself, why did this happen? Try to learn something from it. And when you learn something from it, you can find the causes for the problem, you can undo it, and it doesn't happen again in the future. This is the best way of dealing with these things, yeah? Not to kind of push them away or repress them or suppress them or feel bad or guilty or whatever. None of this really works very well. You make a mistake? Okay, make a mistake. Yeah, it's fine. Everybody makes mistakes. And if you didn't make any mistakes, then you wouldn't be on this retreat anyway. You'd be, sitting somewhere in a cave just meditating happily away now. So it's okay. So this is the first thing, make mistakes. And then if you still feel guilty, or bad about it, then very often, one of the best ways, if it concerns other people, is also to say that you're sorry. Don't get too proud. Yeah? Pride destroys so much. If you really feel something bad, ask for forgiveness. Say, I made a mistake. I'm human. I apologize. Please accept my apology. And any wise person would always accept your apology if they have a little bit of wisdom. And then you feel so much better straight away. You have undone so much of the problem simply by apologizing. Saying you are sorry. And then you can also forgive yourself so much easier now. And this is one of the characteristics of the extreme entry, the Sotapanna, is that Sotapanna's perfection, they are supposed to be perfect in virtue. Perfection in virtue does not mean you never make a mistake. Perfection in virtue means that you confess your mistake straight away. That is what perfection in virtue means. It's interesting, isn't it? You're not perfect, but actually the confession is the thing that makes you perfect in virtue. So this is the right thing. And in this way, you are reducing the problem, the karma problem. Yeah? It becomes less. Remember, you cannot eliminate bad karma. If you make a mistake, it's going to be there on the balance sheet. Yeah? Bad over here, good over there. So your goal is to make the bad one as small as possible and the good one as long as possible. But you're always going to add a little bit to the bad side. And it's okay. It's not going to be tremendously bad as long as you are practicing in the right way. So don't worry too much about it. If the other side is really long, the long and good side, if that's really, really long, the bad side will be diluted. It will be less powerful. There's another teaching of the Buddha, is the idea of diluting your bad actions. And I'm sure you know that's true from personal experience. If you are generally a good person, you can forgive yourself much more easily. Yeah, you can let go of the bad things you do. But if you are generally a bad person, then even small things can affect you in a very bad way. So generally, a good person is easy to dilute the bad karma because of your good mental state. So forgive yourself. But this doesn't mean that you should not worry about your bad actions. Yeah, because I can just forgive myself anyways. What's the big deal? I might as well just do bad and then forgive myself afterwards. It doesn't work like that. As I said, there's always going to be a residue on that bad karma. It's always going to be there. So ideally, you want to avoid it so you don't have that residue at all. Yeah? And the act of forgiveness is never 100%. You forgive yourself, but you can never forgive yourself 100%. You can forgive yourself maybe 90% or 80%, not 100%. And the reason for that is because of the sense of self. The sense of self will always feel a degree of responsibility for the actions that you did. So if you feel a bit of responsibility, you cannot forgive yourself 100%. Why is that? Well, because we identify with the doer. Only the stream enter doesn't identify with the doer. So only the stream enter is able to forgive themselves 100% because they see that their actions were conditioned and they're not really responsible. Okay, I hope that makes sense. Anyway, next one. Dear Ajahn Brahmani, if there are not too many questions now, Now they're not too many, that's good. So could you please tell us how you decided to become a monk 25 years ago? If too many questions, no need to answer. I will ask it another time. Thank you for your wonderful teaching. Okay, I'll put it to one side and then we will see. I will ask the bosses over here whether we have time or not. They can decide. I don't really know how much time we have, so I'm happy we will agree on that. The bosses have more practical concerns. I'm asking about being a monk, you don't really have so many practical concerns because whatever happens is fine there. So, here, Ajahn, can you speak more about situational awareness? How to practice one at work, doing chores, walking in the street, talking, etc. Any resources you would recommend to get deeper in this way of practice with best wishes and better? Yes, this is called Sati Sampradaya. It's a very kind of important part of the Buddhist practice. And the main idea of Sati Sampradaya here, this is one of the cases where I tend to use the commentaries to understand because it's not described in great detail in the suttas, and the commentarial explanation seems to match with how I understand the suttas. So I use that to make sense of it. According to the commentary, there's four types of sati sampradaya, four aspects to it. And one is called the purpose of what you're doing. I think it's called the atta, something like that. I can't remember the Pali words for this. Then there is the suitability of what you're doing, purpose of what you're doing, suitability of what you're doing. And then there is the asamo, I think non-confusion. And then there's the gochara, which is like the object that you're using. Now, of these four, the first two, to my mind, are the far most important ones, the purpose and the suitability. This is what really matters. So, purpose and suitability mean that in anything you do during your day, whether, as you say, when you're walking down the street, or you're eating your food, or you're sleeping at night, or you are talking to someone, or whatever it is that you do, you have awareness of the purpose and suitability of what you're doing. Yes, there is a clear purpose to everything. Why are you walking down the street in Hong Kong? Well, there must be a reason for that. You're going somewhere, you have a purpose, You're not just going to look into the shopping windows, or maybe you are, but maybe already on the wrong track if you do that. But sometimes maybe you are, because it's okay to look in the shop windows. Yeah, if you're a monk or a nun, maybe not, but otherwise it's okay to do that. Otherwise life becomes too kind of restricted sometimes if we don't do these kind of things. So the idea here is to understand the purpose of what you're doing. And remember, the purpose of anything of what you're doing should be to practice the path somehow, to make sure you're moving in the right direction. That should always be the purpose of everything. So when you talk, you don't talk too long, you don't talk too short. I have a problem talking too long. I have so many hours, so much talking, but maybe it's useful. I think I believe that most of the things I say, sometimes maybe I get a bit frivolous and say stupid things, so please tell me off if I do that. But I try to say things that are meaningful, not to say too many silly things. Although I have to also follow my example, who is Ajahn Brahm, so I have to say a few silly things, right? Otherwise I'm a bad disciple of Ajahn Brahm. So you feel the purpose. Am I fulfilling the purpose when I'm talking? Am I fulfilling the purpose when I'm walking down the street? Well, if you're going somewhere, you go there. You don't give rise to defilements as you go there. Yeah, you know what you're doing. When you go into the city as a monk or to a village to receive alms or whatever it is, you watch your mind. Don't get attracted to all the beautiful things in the city. The problem with the city is a sexual realm. The cities where people enjoy themselves. They watch entertainment, they eat in nice restaurants, and Gerald always takes me out to restaurants when I come to Hong Kong. Yeah, it's very sweet, and I quite appreciate that every once and again. It's good, it doesn't really matter. But you try to just do that, not to make too much out of it. You don't wander too much around the city and these sort of things. So you hold back a little bit. You know why you're doing things. When you go to your work, you have situational awareness. You know that the purpose of what you're doing is to get the work done. It's not to do all kinds of other things. So you focus on the work, you get it done, and you do it in a way so it enhances your practice. You do it in a way where you reflect on the satisfaction of the customer and your fellow workers and and everyone around us, everyone gains from what you're doing. It doesn't become just the idea, the kind of modern capitalist idea that shareholders' value is supposed to be increased to the maximum. I think it's a terrible idea, because what about the workers? What about everyone else? You just disregard them? And that's kind of what happens in modern society. You disregard all the people, and all you look at is the money. And it's so destructive for our society when we do things like that. And very often, I think, if you look after the people, and very often the value comes automatically, because people are motivated to practice and do things right if they feel cared for, if they feel looked after by the company, by the boss, or whatever. So what is very interesting, I was recently, there is something in the US called, I think they call the Round Table Conference, or something like that, which is a meeting of all the top executives, all the largest corporations in the US. These are the most powerful business people in the US, like the boss of Goldman Sachs, the boss of, what's it called, J.P. Morgan, this big bank, of the General Electric and General Motors or whatever. Yeah, they're really, really big and top companies in the US. I know about this a little bit because I used to study finance, believe it or not, before I became a monk a long time ago. So, and they came together and they decided, I had very recently, a few months ago, they decided that we're going to have to throw out this capitalist idea that all we have to do is to optimize shareholders' value. Yeah, this is really significant because it means there's a new kind of idea arising here. Actually, instead we should optimize not just the shareholders' value, but the stakeholders' value. Stakeholder is everyone who has some involvement with a company. Employees, customers, and you know, anyone who's kind of involved with it. And this is such a much more beautiful way of thinking about things. And this has now penetrated to the very top of even American corporate culture. That means sometimes the world has gone in the right direction, yeah? Some things are good, some things are bad. On balance, it's the same, almost the same, but some of things are heading in the right direction. So this is this is how we should all think, yeah? We should all use that kind of value. This is a Buddhist way of valuing things. Because when you do it in that way, you can combine your worldly activities with your spiritual path. Look after yourself as well, not just others. Yeah? Know the limits for work. Don't work so that you only sleep 4 hours a night or whatever it is. Because you will have so much dukkha and you won't be able to practice anymore if you only sleep 4 hours a night. You're going to walk around like a zombie. Yeah, not knowing up from down and black from white. So you're gonna have a serious problem. So look after yourself. You also need to be cared for. Yeah? You need to be able to be white enough to be able to have mindfulness, to watch your mind, all of these kind of things. So this is Sampradaya in the workplace. You understand the purpose ultimately is to enhance the spiritual practice. Suitability, well, there are certain things that are unsuitable for spiritual practice. There are certain places you probably shouldn't go. Many years ago, I remember with my parents, I was here in Hong Kong. I was a monk, it was before Rift and all of that. But I was here in Hong Kong with my parents were going to take me around. We went to Shanghai in China, and we went to Macau. Very interesting, because Macau is like the gambling capital of China, of Asia. Yeah? So, because we knew we were in the gambling capital, we had to look at one of those casinos. So I was a monk already, so we walked into this casino as a monk. Now I know why you should never go to a casino as a monk. It's terrible place. It's so dark, it's like walking into this ghost realm when you go into a casino. You probably have been to casinos many of you, you just been there, kind of looked at it. And it's very unpleasant. And you get this feeling that they're trying to constantly manipulate you to kind of use more money on these machines. So I walked in there, I could tell there was something wrong. I didn't really know at the time. I felt something felt wrong. I don't think they liked the idea of having a monk in the casino. But I didn't go to the gaming floor because I knew that would be wrong, so I just walked around there. These casinos are so enormous, yeah? They have restaurants there and all kinds of things and shops and whatever. So I never went to the gaming floor, I went to some of the other parts, and I felt very unpleasant. I never wanted to go to a casino again for the rest of my life after that. Casino, not suitable plants. Yeah, so that is kind of not suitable. I understood that part of Sampradaya after having been to a casino. And there are many places like that that are drag you in the wrong way, yeah, that are really destructive, that all they do is bring out your worst defilements, bring out ill will, bring out desires in you. Yeah. And you know what those places are. Yeah, you can feel that. Sometimes the airports are a bit like that, because airports are this arena of all kind of high-end, high-quality shops that you go shopping. Yeah? So when I go to the airport, I just kind of walk straight through. It's kind of almost unpleasant to be there, because you have this feeling everyone's trying to push something onto you by through all these fancy shops. So this is how you think, yeah? This is what this meant by me say. And if you think like this, in terms of suitability, purpose, what is the purpose, what am I trying to achieve, is this I'm doing now, is it suitable for that purpose, am I thinking about it in the right way, that is what Sampradaya is about. And you can use that in almost all aspects of your life, yeah, and this will be very helpful to be able to keep mindfulness and to be able to live with all the right virtues and all these kind of things. Okay. Here, Arjuna. Awesome. You have read all the sutras. Actually, not quite. There was, I think, one sutra that I didn't read. So, but otherwise, I think we got them all. So, yeah. Close. Can you give a visual idea of how much by volume all the sutras take? How come there are so many sutras? Were many written long after the times of the Buddha? Then what makes the difference between sutra and commentaries? Thank you. A visual idea of how much by volume, okay, visual idea, sutra, like that. Yeah, if you put all the books together, maybe that long, all the sutras. Something like that. In the Agamas, interesting, it's only that much. I think the Chinese is much more compressed kind of language. Chinese, very kind of each character means a lot, so you can compress everything much more or something. Yeah. So that's why Chinese is more efficient. Maybe efficient way of reading the sutras. So it's quite a lot. And what is the Latin that we find there is actually the word of the Buddha. Yeah? So if you want to know what the word of the Buddha is, four Nikayas, long discourses, midlength discourses, collective discourses, and numerical discourses, four Nikayas. This is really the word of the Buddha, and a little bit more than that. Yeah, there's a few collections known as the Udana, which probably is partly the word of the Buddha, only partly. Dhammapada, Sutta Nipata, probably as well, parts of that. But the four main collections, the main thing, and then the Vinaya Pitaka, a fair amount from the Vinaya Pitaka. This is the word of the Buddha. So we can imagine if someone like the Buddha was teaching every day, it actually does add up to about that much, yeah? It does, because if you teach every day, after a while we have given a few thousand talks, and there are a few thousand sutras, so it kind of makes sense. So it's not unreasonable. But there are lots of so-called sutras, which I've noticed you use the word sutra, and not sutta. Sutta is kind of the Pali, sutra is Sanskrit. Lots of sutras that are not the word of the Buddha. So if you go to the Chinese Buddhist canon, yeah, written all in Chinese, and if you go to all the Mahayana sutras, they also exist in Sanskrit as well as Chinese and in Tibet and many others. You have to go to that small section known as the Agamas, yeah, equivalent to the Nikaya. That's where you find the Buddhist teachings. All the other stuff, even though it says this was spoken by the Buddha, it was not spoken by the Buddha. And perhaps you think I say that because I'm a Theravada monk. That's why I kind of dismiss those bad Mahayana people. Yeah, because I really don't like Mahayana people. I mean, that's what you think. But not really. These are the results of modern scholarship. Everybody knows this is true. There's a famous Taiwanese monk called Yin Shun, yeah? Very famous in Taiwan. He was the one who came from mainland China originally, and he moved to Taiwan at the time of the civil war and things in China. So he went to Taiwan, and then he is the main spiritual person behind the Four Wan Chan and many of the other big kind of Buddhist groups in Taiwan. Four Wan Chan and the or mind is a bit blurry now, I can't remember these things, but you know, all the Dharma Mountain and some of these things were all inspired by him. He's one of the most famous Chinese Buddhist monks anywhere, very, very famous. And he said, yeah, he studied the sutras very deeply, and he was kind of revolutionary. And he said that, well, actually, if you want the word of the Buddha, these arguments actually where you find this is the real word of the Buddha. And so even he agreed with that. So this is basically, these are the findings of modern scholarship. Everyone knows that these Buddha sutras are later than those early sutras. And you can know that for many, many reasons. First of all, the one reason is because the ideas in the early sutras are the foundational ideas. The other ideas are built upon those basic ideas, so they are a later development in philosophy and thinking. Yeah? The language, the evolution in language, the later languages of this other sutras is built upon the more simple language you find in the Pali sutras, even earlier sometimes. Yeah? There's an evolution in that. There's an evolution in you know, philosophy, in language, etc., etc. You can build up a very, very strong case that these things are later. So everybody knows that. So that's what you have to do. You have to make that distinction between the early sutras and later things. And those later sutras, they're not necessarily bad. Yeah, they can still be interesting. Some of them accord with the early sutras, some of them do not. So they're not necessarily all bad, but if you really want to go into the Buddha, if you want to make sure, I would always recommend you to come back to the early sutras, the four Nikaya. That's where you really find the Buddhist teachings. So when I talk about these things, I'm not so interested in the Mahayana sutras. I don't really know much about them. I've never really read them. I wasn't really all interested. I read a little bit, tongue a little bit here and there, but not very much. Not so interested in the commentaries. Not so interested in the Abhidhamma, not so interested in the Suttamagga, not so interested in modern Buddhism, whatever it is. I'm basically interested most of all in the word of the Buddha. Because that is the fountain, that is the basis for everything else. Of course, it is impossible to dismiss everything else. You have to take it on board sometimes, but that is kind of the focus. So, yeah, so that is roughly how I would recommend you, if you want my recommendation, I would recommend you to read those things. Yeah, these are the things that are really important. So, there is this one, is it another question then? Yeah, okay. Okay, very good, okay. Okay, thank you, Freddy. So, one more question. Especially you have that. In the Satipatthana Sutta, there is a practice of the asubha to contemplate of the death of the body and so on. Here I have to practice those objects. How can we practice? Should we go to the cemetery or just by imagination? Thank you very much. You can do these things by imagination. You don't have to go to the cemetery. Yeah? And if you look at the I think the 31 parts of the body. Is it 31 or 32? 32? Are you sure? It's not 31? Okay. This is the test to see whether you are reading the Suttamagga or the Suttas. The Suttas 31, Suttamagga 32, yeah? This is what I always like to ask people, because then you know how influential the Suttamagga is. Everyone says 32. Actually, it's 31 in the Suttas. So the Suttamagga becomes more important than the Suttas. This is just a test. Anyway, so I think it says in there, the way it is explained, as if it is an exercise in imagination. Yeah? You reflect on it. You think about it just as this is the case. And so you see this part of the body. And the same thing with the cemetery contemplations, they are also explained in such a way, I can't remember exactly how it is explained now, unfortunately, but it is explained in such a way that it looks like it is exercise and imagination rather than having to go there. Yeah? You don't really have to go to the cemetery. You can. I know that sometimes monks in Thailand, for example, you can go to the autopsy and you can see people cutting up the bodies. And sometimes you end up vomiting if not using it. It's so incredibly unpleasant to see this. It's like, oh, I've never done it, but I've heard people, you know, just can't take it, basically. So that's very hard to understand. As a Ram did it, it didn't affect him very much. He was just like, oh yeah, whatever. And he's very, got a very strong mind. So, in the end, you know, the monks do that and they destroy them anyway afterwards. Yeah, it's not just have that kind of, it's not seeing it visually, you have to internalize it. And for internalizing it, you need to kind of imagine these things. That's how it becomes powerful. So imagining is enough. And do it on your own body. Yeah? Heart, lungs, liver, you know, everything is there. And it's a useful exercise because the reason why the body sometimes looks beautiful is because of the skin. Think about the skin. Certainly the body is not that attractive anymore. Yeah? So it's very useful to, it can be very useful to do that. But these are the things that you do. You can do them to reduce attachment to the body and these things. It can be useful now. But it is not really necessary. If your meditation is going well and you're already having success in samadhi, you don't actually have to do these things. So it really depends on how much attachment you feel you have to the body and these things. Okay. So it is almost 3 o'clock, so I'm going to maybe answer very briefly. Can I do that? Yeah, the last question? Is that okay? The question about how I become a monk. Yes, someone wanted to ask that. How I decided to become a monk. Yeah, I think I did touch on that briefly before, earlier on. But it's very strange. Yeah, how do you become a monk? Because it's one of those things that are very, very difficult to explain and even to understand yourself sometimes. It just seems to happen. One day, oops, I'm a monk now. How did this happen? Okay. So, the answer is, you know, one of the things I remember from my childhood, and these are the kind of indications that you are on track to become a monk, perhaps. One of the things I remember when I was very young, I was maybe 12 years old or something, and I remember having this fantasy of living by myself in a small hut in the forest. That sounded to me like the best thing I could do in my life, was to live in a small hut in the forest and kind of contemplate about life. This was kind of my idea of fun when I was 12 years old. So I thought, where did that come from? Yeah, I didn't hear of any other 12 years old that had this kind of fantasy. And it was just an image that appeared in my mind somehow. Yeah, where did it come from? And I think that, you know, now, being having been a Buddhist for a long time, I think very likely that is some kind of something that comes from my past lives. Yeah? Where else would it come from? I didn't know any monks, I didn't know anyone, I didn't know any religious people. My family was completely non-religious, I didn't believe in anything. Yeah, except being kind and caring, I mean, they believed in that much, but they didn't really believe in anything religious. So where does it come from? And I think it comes, must be some seed inside of you that comes out at this particular time. And then later on, when I got older, I wanted to travel to Asia. Yeah, I thought it would be really nice to travel to Asia. So I got a chance to travel to Japan when I was 21. I was at university, I was studying engineering. And they had this exchange program. Yeah, students kind of just exchange around the world. So they had, oh, we have an opening, do you want to go to Japan? Yeah, I'd love to go to Japan. I had a close friend in that committee who decided, corruption, When you have a close friend and you think that much easier, it's always like that. Yeah, friendships always get you to places. Nepotism and corruption is always the kind of, okay, I'm not going to say anymore. So I got the chance to go to Japan, and that's when I read my first book on Buddhism. Yes, I went to Japan, I went to Kyoto, the ancient capital of Japan, I went to Nara, the even older capital. I saw the Buddhist monasteries, I saw the giant Buddha statues everywhere in these ancient capitals. I read my first book on Buddhism that was published by a Taiwanese organization called the Corporate Buddhist Organization, that's a well-known publisher in Japan. They have these books in the hotel rooms. Like in the West, you have the Bible in the hotel room. In Asia, they have this Buddhist book in the hotel room. So, interesting. Okay, so I started reading Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path. It's very interesting. It was a little bit too, the way it was framed was a bit too religious. And that's why it didn't attract me so much. It was too much kind of supernormal powers, all kind of weird stuff. So I think that they didn't really succeed in creating a proper missionary book, because it was too much cultural Buddhism rather than good Dharma teachings. It could have done a far better job of it. So I wasn't that attracted to it, but there were some things about it that were quite nice. So this is how things started out. Yeah? This was very interesting to me. And then when I got back to Norway again, one of my very best friends, who has later on become super duper successful in his career, all these kind of things, he's really super smart fellow, he had a book on meditation practice. He said, here, read this. Okay, thank you. I got this book, it was about breath meditation. So I started doing breath meditation. It's weird how these things come together. I don't really understand. How does these things kind of randomly come together? This was written by, because he's one of these people who was interested in everything, so he would do all kind of things. So he would kind of give me this, this is the nice thing about being friends with people who are different and who kind of look at the world in different ways. You get input, you don't get anywhere else. So he gave me this book. This was it wasn't a religious book, it was a secular book on mindfulness of breathing. So I tried it out and had some really nice results. I thought, wow, this is really cool. Yeah, I was still just a university student, but it had some really nice results. And then later on, I continued my studies. I was studying in London. I was studying finance in London. And of all things, you can imagine studying finance in London. And I felt this is really meaningless. What am I doing this for? This doesn't make any sense. And I thought back to the time I had meditated before. This is what I want to do. So then I called up the organization, asked, is there any Buddhist place around here? I can go to like a Buddhist monastery or something. And I said, go to a Chitra's from the Monkey Monastery. You know, monasteries in Ajahn Chali. So I went there. Yeah? That's how I got started there. And then gradually I heard about Ajahn Brahma actually. I said, okay, Ajahn Brahma is my teacher. So I went to Australia. This is how it happened. So what is it that happened? Is it because I'm really smart, so I can see Buddhism is the best? Is that what happens? Probably not. Yeah, I probably know we're smarter than anyone else. It's just that you're there. So what is it that's going on? And I think that what I think is going on, this is what I said before, that it's awakening something that is already inside of you. The seed is already there. Yeah, you already have some understanding of this teaching deep inside of you. And it awakens that seed, and you recognize this as something here that is very powerful. And then, where does that seed come from? Well, it might have come from a past life, yeah? So that's why I'm pretty sure I would have been a monastic in a past life. And as I said the other day, I said that maybe I wasn't done in a past life. Quite likely I was a Buddhist monk. Why not? Yeah, this is kind of life. You change from one gender to another one. You move around one nationality to another one. That's what I think now. So it's not that I'm very smart. It's not that I'm very spiritually advanced. It's just that I have a habit from the past. And I'm following that habit. It happens to be a good habit, but it's still a habit. It's kind of embarrassing, isn't it? I have to admit that. It's a habit. People think, wow, you're a Buddhist monk, that's really cool. Actually, it's not cool at all, it just happens. Yeah? It's habitual things happening there. It's such a nice way of thinking about it. There's no sense of, you can take away the ego. You can take away the idea that you are special somehow. You're not special at all, just like everyone else. Just follow your habits. It's a beautiful way. It takes away any kind of pride or any stupid ideas about anything like that. So that's why I think I'm a Buddhist monk. But the reason I'm a Buddhist monk now is quite different, because now, after having been a monk for 25 years, having read the suttas and having investigated them, I don't really have much doubt anymore that this is the meaning of life. This is what it's all about. Everything else seems stupid to me. I don't understand anything about how people can just bear to live a completely ordinary life, just work for money and status, to be such completely empty and pointless. I don't know how anyone can do that in all seriousness. So now it is very different. Now it is a very strong sense that this is actually what life is about. But once you have found the meaning of life, what else are you going to do with that? You can't stop being a Buddhist monk and do something else, and do something which is not the meaning of life. If you found the meaning of life, that would be completely crazy. If you found the meaning of life, you have to do it, precisely because it is the meaning. It's pretty obvious, isn't it? So if you kind of want to move to, if you want to go somewhere, and that's the meaning, you can't go somewhere else because you need to go there. If you think, you know, if you want to be find happiness, you want to find purpose, you want to find the highest kind of what life is all about, if you have found that, you can't do anything else anymore because it's kind of crazy to do something else if you found the meaning there. So that's kind of the story. That's why my Buddhist monks. I hope that doesn't disappoint you too much. But that's kind of reality is often very disappointing. Yeah? Reality is often so ordinary. Wow, so ordinary. And it's okay. It should be ordinary. Whenever you did hear tall stories that are too hard to believe, probably is because they are not actually true now. So that's kind of how these things work. Yeah? Anyway, shall we do a little bit of meditation before we call it do the last thing that's on the list? Let's do a little bit of metta meditation just to wish everyone well. This is even more important than chanting the Metta Sutta. Someone suggested chanting the Metta Sutta yesterday, but let's at the very least do some metta meditation because that is even more important. Okay, so get ready. enjoy this delicious peace until the very last moment. And you can also feel a sense of gratitude for having been here, for the fact that we did such a thing as the Kandura Center, that there are people who organize these retreats and all of this. And the wonderful thing that is, to feel a bit of beautiful gratitude for having this opportunity. Also gratitude to yourself for taking yourself here. These positive feelings are so important for meditation practice. Now, if you wish, try to bring to mind the idea of the strong spiritual qualities that we're trying to develop here, the kindness, the compassion, the generosity, and these kind of qualities. And they're already in abundance here. And try to reflect on what these qualities mean. Try to reflect on some people who really have these qualities to a high degree. Think back to what these qualities feel like in your own life. And have a sense of gratitude for the fact that these qualities exist in this world, and we also are trying to practice them. pretend that now if you bring them, just visualize one of the four directions, maybe the western direction, and it doesn't matter where it is, just visualize the western direction as far as you can. Remember all the beings in the western direction, and remember the world is full of people, like the people you have just been contemplating here. The whole western direction is full of kindness, compassion, care, generosity, and all of these wonderful things. So see those qualities in the western direction. See it's not something you need to work very hard at. Just bring up an image in your mind of these qualities in the western area. And then thank all those beings, all those people out there. Thank you for being part of my life. sadness and feeling for all these spiritual qualities. At this time, if you wish, you can also bring in the animals in the world, the animals in the eastern direction, because animals are so much more vulnerable than human beings are. And most animals, they also want to be happy. So mix a bit of compassion into the matter, and wish all those beings in the western direction, including all the animals, may you be well, may you be happy. visualize the beautiful world in this way and wish all these beings well. May you all be well and happy. if we feel more at ease, and if we feel that the good states have been cultivated and growing, and again, try to understand how this works, and what is the causality behind this. Take a few moments to reflect on this.
Doing.
Yeah, Buddhist classes are doing less for doing more, so I'm really good. Actually, what we should do, we should always finish off with your paying to the respect of the Buddha and the Sangha. Do this one last time, guys. Let's do this to the Arahant Sangha Sangha one more time.
Sadhu, sadhu.